Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I want to preview the rest of the program. We're going to talk about, first, about an opportunistic surgical preventative surgery for ovarian cancer for persons with ovaries. Also, brain zapping and brain-computer interfaces follow that. And finally, the good, the bad, and the ugly in health policy in the last few weeks. Now we'll go to Mary from Davenport. And Mary wrote, "Ask Dr. Dawn, Amlexinox. Dear Dr. Dawn, are you familiar with using Amlexinox for MCAS? And MCAS, folks, is mast cell activation syndrome. If so, I would love to hear your thoughts, such as how it's used, if helpful for gut issues, how common are side effects, efficacy, and whichever of those other thoughts you might have. I'm curious for how long it's been used in this manner, too." Well, Mary, those are a lot of questions, and I think I'm going to just start off with defining mast cell activation syndrome so that the audience can be on the same page. So a mast cell, well, it's lurking around. It's in your lungs. It's in your nose. It's in your blood. It's in your gut. And mast cells are basically, if you want to visualize that you're in that movie Fantastic Voyage where you can actually see white blood cells, the white blood cells in that movie were just about the size of a gallon Ziploc bag. There's a wonderful scene. You should check it on YouTube. It's sort of lascivious science fiction. Poor Raquel Welch in her skin-tight Voyager suit gets stranded outside the ship, which is non-antigenic, and is immediately recognized by the immune system as something babelicious, and hundreds of white cells jump onto her body. The other crew members haul her back in and grab her and pull all of the white cells off while she wiggles and screams. It's a wonderful scene. Anyway, where was I? Oh, mast cells. So, gallon bag filled with 100 little snack bags, maybe 200. How many snack bags could you fit in a gallon bag? Inside each of those snack bags are a host of chemical signals: histamine, bradykinin, leukotrienes, slow reactive substance of anaphylaxis, and a host of other chemical signals whose job basically is to say to various different cells in the immune system and blood vessels, hey there, wake up over here. Please come. We have an emergency. And bring all your tools and your friends. So it is a summons and also a trigger. The release of histamine actually triggers a lot of what we call vasoactive symptoms. Histamine's actually a neurotransmitter. And among other things, in mast cell activation syndrome, you will get potentially asthma-like symptoms. You'll get wheezing. You'll get shortness of breath. You'll get sudden onset nasal congestion. As far as abdominal symptoms are concerned, you'll get cramps, diarrhea, maybe vomiting, maybe nausea. But you won't get bloating and constipation. Those are not part of mast cell activation syndrome. You'll get low blood pressure, but you won't get POTS, and which is where your pulse also goes up. You will have lots of skin symptoms. Your skin will flush. You'll get hives. The skin on the inside of your mouth and throat may swell. We call that angioedema, and that can be very dangerous. People who get that as part of their mast cell activation syndrome need to carry around an EpiPen because that'll kill you. And hypotension, those sound an awful lot like anaphylaxis. And indeed, certain people with severe mast cell activation syndrome will go into anaphylaxis, and that can cause vascular collapse and death. and is very serious. And like I said, those people have to have an EpiPen. The criteria for this are you have to have two of these categories that go off. So the skin, the blood pressure, the abdominal, or the respiratory. You have to have two or more things going on. And it has to repeat. There is one reasonably good blood test for it. And if a person seems to have this, what we doctors will do is we'll try to get them in right after a flare, like the day of, and get a serum tryptase. And we'll also want to wait until they're symptom-free and get another serum tryptase, because some people just make a lot of that all the time. But if you don't make a lot of it all the time and you have a lot of it floating around in your blood in the aftermath of an attack, then that makes the diagnosis. Now, the Amlexinox is kind of the, I won't say flavor of the month, because it's, with the internet, it's more like flavor of the week. But there's been a lot going around about this agent as a sort of internet influencer, I know something you don't know moment. And there isn't, it's, first thing to say is that this was never FDA approved to be put in capsules and taken orally. The only FDA approval it ever had was as a paste to be applied to cold sores, canker sores. And it was there as an analgesic. It does have antihistamine-like properties, and it has been approved in other countries to be given as an antihistamine. I looked and was not able to find much in the way of an authoritative source for side effects. I drew these side effects from from an AI search, and so it's not FDA approved. There's not a lot of research. It was originally approved in Japan as a treatment for asthma. This was not ever, I don't believe that I could find, anywhere used for mast cell activation syndrome. It's kind of a logical extension. The most common side effects, ironically enough, are diarrhea, nausea, and cramping, and a metallic taste in the mouth. Paradoxical hives are also mentioned. It's rare, but does happen that people have been reported to drop their platelets to dangerously low levels and be at risk for bleeding. And there are a couple of cases of aplastic anemia listed as, you know, yes, this happened, and also elevated liver function tests. So I would say that you really want to look up mast cell activation syndrome and be sure that you actually meet the criteria for this before I would play around in this particular sandbox. This must be compounded, and I did see most of what I saw on just searching for the name was one particular compounding pharmacy who was pushing it, and I saw that their article had gotten cloned by several influencers, at which point I just kind of stood back and say, okay, it's one of those. That doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's not supported. There isn't a lot of actual data that supports its use, except for that the Japanese study that I mentioned was using it for asthma. And if you did decide to go and try to get this compounded into capsules and take it for your having, you know, really verified that you think you actually have this mast cell activation syndrome, then I would be very careful with what the compounding pharmacy used for its filler, because to fill a capsule, they're going to mix it with something. My recommendation would be methylcrystalline cellulose. That is a very good inert product, and that would be what you want, something inert that's unlikely to cause a mast cell outbreak. And be careful about, you know, the listings on the influencer pages and on the compounding pages, because those people are making money off of this. And they actually make money when you read their thing. And there's a tendency to write persuasively so that you will go on and read the next thing. And we all have this cognitive bias to say, Yeah, I have that. I have that symptom. Yeah, I have that symptom too. I guess I must have this condition. And it really doesn't work that way. So the first thing to do, just to repeat, verify you've got it, or at least really look critically at that assumption, and then look critically at who's going to be making it for you. And, you know, I would go with the regular treatments before I went to this sort of little bit shady agent, and hard to get a good quality one necessarily, and you can't validate it. I'd go with the stuff that actually gets spot checked by the FDA and validated, like antihistamines, leukotriene inhibitors, that would be montelukast, chromalin, a very, very safe drug, quercetin, an herb, those two are mast cell stabilizers. Aspirin for the flushing seems to work pretty well. There is an expensive inhaler called Xolair, which actually is antibodies against IgE, which means that the mast cells become less reactive because the thing that triggers them disappears, and an EpiPen. So if you have severe symptoms, you really should have an EpiPen. I hope that helps. I would give the Amlexinox a C, and that the C is basically because there's really not good evidence of safety, and it's never been approved for mast cell activation syndrome. So it's a bit of a leap of logic, and there's so many other substitutes. It isn't the first place I would go. Now, I promised you opportunistic salpingectomy. So most ovarian cancers, turns out, don't actually start in the ovaries. They start in the fallopian tube, specifically in the fimbriae of the fallopian tubes. I found that rather interesting. And the concept here is a very interesting one. So the research says that about 80% of cancers, which are usually, including nearly all the fatal cases, are actually cancers of the fallopian tubes. These are the tubes that carry a sort of feathery type of extension that just brushes over the ovaries with movements. And so any egg that pops out typically is going to get brushed into, swept, if you will, into the tube and head down towards the uterus, which is where the baby needs to get to when the egg is fertilized. So fertilization typically takes place in the tubes, by the way. And so what hits the uterus is already fertilized, has 46 chromosomes, and is raring to start growing. We can't catch ovarian cancer early enough a lot of the times. It's one of our deadliest cancers, and we don't have good early screening. But removing the fallopian tubes might reduce the risk by as much as 80%, and the procedure takes about 5 minutes. And here's the thing. It can be tacked on to almost any abdominal surgery. For example, rather than a tubal ligation for sterilization, maybe do a salpingectomy, and not only remove the possibility of a pregnancy, but also remove the possibility of an ovarian cancer for the rest of your life, or at least drastically reduce it. So the American even a hernia surgery, a gallbladder removal, an appendectomy, lots of people have abdominal surgery. And if you're female, the push is going to be to say, would you like an elective removal of your tubes? If you're done with your childbearing, this is irreversible sterilization, of course, but it also carries the benefit of removing your cancer risk. One oncologist looked at their old records and realized that about fully a quarter of her ovarian cancer patients had undergone an earlier surgery of the abdomen, which would have been a candidate surgery for elective salpingectomies. And she said that it's one of the most critical discoveries in my lifetime. That's going pretty far for an oncologist. Is the data solid enough to make this kind of recommendation? Well, yes and no. Okay, probably the simplest thing to say is we don't have any placebo-controlled double-blind trials, and the studies are all epidemiological, looking backwards at two groups, a group that had their tubes removed for some reason and the group that didn't, and looking at, you know, how much cancer did they have. The largest study, one of the largest single studies was from Sweden, 3,000 women, not great. A large cohort study coming out of, Canada, came up with an odds ratio of about points, a risk reduction of about 60%. A Danish study came in with an odds ratio of 46, which would be a risk reduction of 54%. A risk reduction in another cohort. There's lots of registry studies that have looked at in the Danish data, the Swedish data. We kind of have to follow into the category of we won't really know until that this is a good thing to do until we start doing it and wait about 15, 20 years, and then we'll know if it's a good thing to do. So in the meantime, my recommendation here is if you are done with your child rearing, and particularly if you have a family history of breast or ovarian cancer, or your BRCA, it might make sense. Let's suppose you find out that you are BRCA1 or BRCA2. Now, typically women will have a hysterectomy. They will typically have their ovaries removed and their tubes removed and often their breasts removed as a preventative surgery because they have a genetic tendency. We don't know whether removing the fallopian tubes will work in Lynch syndrome. However, if I had Lynch syndrome and I was getting a resection for a colon cancer, I'd probably say, yeah, take the fallopian tubes while you're there. If I had Lynch syndrome, I would necessarily be wanting to pass that on to my children anyway. It's going to be a matter of individual calculus. It's going to require, taking some time to educate the patients. It's going to require thoughtfulness, and it can't be done in a one-size-fits-all way, which is the sort of hallmark right now of where medicine is going, protocol-based, one-size-fits-all. We all need to resist that. We all need to, what was the movie where the guy like yells, "I'm not a number," or something like that? I know there was a song too, but I actually think there was a movie. The point is, we're not a number. We're not a statistic. We don't get 0.73 of a disease. We get the disease or we don't get the disease. So statistics and algorithms are all well and good, but we need to keep the personal in medicine. And as you know, I'm a strong advocate for that and will continue to do so. So let's move on to the brainwaves. A brand new generation of deep brain stimulation might really prove to be a game changer. Deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease has been going on for at least 25 years. There are over 200,000 people who have been fitted with these stimulators for their Parkinson's disease. The stimulators help calm the tremors and the rigidity. And just as it happens in the last 6 years, the 40,000 of those in the United States who received devices made after 2020 got them with a special feature which was turned off, but can be turned on essentially with a firmware upgrade, which is to say non-surgically, just by messing with the software of the device. These devices can read brainwaves and then tailor and adapt the rhythm of their output. Normally, deep brain stimulators act a little bit like the old dumb pacemakers from 30 or 40, probably 50 years ago, where it just sends a beep, 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 and causes the heart to beat. Those weren't very good initially. They kept you from dying, but it made it hard to exercise because they wouldn't accelerate with demand. Later versions did exactly that. They looked at the demand and they changed the heartbeat accordingly. These new devices can do something similar with brain waves. They can, this is called adaptive deep brain stimulation. And it's a pretty amazing technology. So let's talk about our problems with Parkinson's. First of all, Parkinson's disease is very prevalent. There's 1.2 million people in the United States, 1 million people in the U.S. and 1.2 in Europe who already have Parkinson's disease. That obviously makes it a very large market for improving the product. And we have a product. We've had drugs that have been used for a long time. Anyone who saw that movie Awakenings, where the people with the who were all frozen, they got L-DOPA, and they came back to normal. The problem is taking these drugs, L-DOPA, levodopa, carbidopa, doesn't mimic what's going on in the brain. In the brain, you've got a constant release of dopamine, not an oral medication that passes into the system and then peaks and then declines. And no matter how long acting and how stabilized we make it, it still doesn't come close to what the healthy brain is doing. And that means the symptoms vary throughout the day. You get involuntary movements in the morning because you've just taken your first pill. And then as the drug wears off, you get more and more rigid later in the day. Sometimes the variation is terrible. Sometimes the drug side effects cause such nausea that a person's incapacitated. So that's when people get the deep brain stimulator. And there's electrodes that go down deep into the brain, into the basal ganglia, and they just send a beat, a regular pulse, throughout 24 hours. It helps regulate the body movements. But unfortunately, they also can amplify the side effects. So because they're contributing, if you have the agitation phase, they might make it worse. Sometimes they get changes in behavior, sudden onset gambling disorders, and temporary changes in impulse control related to the deep brain stimulators. And because these can be turned off, we're pretty sure that they are directly associated with the stimulator, because the urge to gamble goes away, the speech changes go away. Sometimes there's speech slurring, for example. And where do we go when we're talking about what's going on in the brain? Well, one of the things that we now have with these stimulators down in the brain is we can look at what the brain waves are doing with a fairly high degree of accuracy. And brain waves are, as we call them waves, they have a cycle. And the frequency of that cycle tells you a lot about what's going on in the brain. And the cycle of greatest interest for Parkinson's is one called beta oscillations, and this is between 13 and 30 hertz or beats per second. And it's the beta oscillations are an important marker of what's going on in the motor. People with Parkinson's have intense bursts of activities in this region. When the drug treatments are working, these bursts of intensity are reduced. And the same is true for deep brain stimulation. The more that stimulation normalizes and reduces the beta oscillations, the better the relief of the symptoms. So it's been about 25 years that they've been able to study these oscillations. And now they can really kind of read and tune them. And they've found this one for Parkinson's, but they're also looking at not just listening, but playing back. So the first 8 and 10 years of the research was in getting the hardware up to the point where it could read and tell the researchers what was going on. Then they started modulating the amount and frequency of the stimulation. Remember, that had been fixed in the old technology. Now you have a deep brain stimulator that reduces stimulation when the beta oscillation intensity begins to dip. It says, okay, it's going to dip from the medication. I'm going to reduce the stimulation to keep that beta in a healthy range. I don't want to keep it from getting oversuppressed. As the medication wears off, it does the opposite. It kicks up its stimulation, and therefore, instead of having these cliffs and troughs, you have a smoother up and down, which makes it much easier for the patient because the swings between being frozen and being agitated and tremoring are much reduced. It really improves the quality of life. It's been tried in small groups, and we're seeing really interesting benefits from that. Now, this technology was embedded into the device, but not activated. So that the technology of the active deep brain stimulation, the adaptive deep brain stimulation, that's just in the lab, but it's also in the device. The capacity is in the device. And so many people who had that device inserted have been in clinical trials to validate to the FDA that this is actually a thing and that it does good and that it should be approved. One of the things they found that emerged was that it really helped with sleep. And insomnia is a big problem for Parkinson's disease. And we think that if you don't sleep, you, of course, we know, get more inflammation in the brain. And we think that makes the Parkinson's degrade your brain faster. So deep brain stimulation of the adaptive sort may actually help prevent the progression of cancer, of Parkinson's disease. So you can make a case, perhaps, with research that let's try putting it into people with early Parkinson's disease and see if we can slow their progression. Now, about a quarter of people who have a deep brain implant use it for something else. Dystonia, which is a movement disorder that causes the muscles to contract, essential tremor, and also obsessive compulsive disorder. They're also studying it for Tourette's syndrome. A group in Holland found really clear associations between compulsions and specific brain signatures, and using adaptive BDS to sort of counteract those brain signatures, canceling them out, so to speak, is showing potential for the treatment of OCD without drugs. Now, of course, putting something in the brain is a big step, and we're a long way from making this the first place that we go. There's some idea that maybe it will work in depression. I'm a little skeptical about that. I think there is a Parkinson's disease that is a specific disease that we can identify. I think depression is a clinical diagnosis, and I think there are a bunch of different depressions that we're all lumping together, and that's why we haven't really burst that bubble. We have drugs that work in any given group maybe 70% of the time, not working at all for 30%, and a different drug, same thing, different 30%, some overlap. We're not there. Maybe we'll get there this way. I'm a little skeptical about that, but we do need to develop and approve this technology, because the drugs, simply as well-intended as they are, this is an ugly disease, and the drugs just aren't doing the job. So China is emerging as a big player in brain-computer interfaces. We'll be talking a little bit about a company called StareMed, that built something called the BCI system. It's very similar to implants that are being trialed by Neuralink, which is located in nearby Fremont. StairMed's device has fewer probes than Neuralink's, but it's smaller and a little less invasive. Now, China doesn't have a long history in the field, and oh, surprise, surprise, many of the devices being trialed there are simplified versions of those developed by U.S. companies. What a coincidence. But, nevertheless, it's developing very fast. The Chinese are improving the algorithms, and they're improving the implantation devices, and the Chinese government is funding the heck out of this. They've identified brain-computer systems as a priority area, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to have nightmares about this tonight. Priority area, and they are funding agencies are pouring money into the field. A lot of young scientists are getting involved in this, and just about all of them have industry ties. The country also has the medical infrastructure and population to test and validate these technologies. Progress can be made here to benefit patients and researchers worldwide, and progress can be made much faster in a place where there is no possibility of tort lawyers coming back at you for damages and no class action suits for lying to the patients. So, yeah. Let's talk about the devices. One BCI device being trialed is a small wireless device. Its purpose ostensibly is to restore hand movement in a person with paralysis. And it's basically a pneumatic glove. 8 probes are placed on the dura mater, so they don't actually touch the brain. This is going to lower the risk of infection a lot. And so that's, you know, that's a very good bridge technology. The person who was paralyzed was able to, wearing the glove, they were able to open and close their hand, strengthen their grip, and after about 20 months, they can use it to eat and drink. About 20 individuals have received this experimental implant. The approach that we're talking about here, putting something on top of the dura mater, it means that it isn't very specific, not like the deep brain probes that can so carefully measure the brain waves that I was talking about in terms of the deep brain stimulators for Parkinson's. But the minimal invasiveness is good, and it makes the approach appropriate for controlling simple movements. And that can be really meaningful. Now, when we get into deep brain, about 2 years ago, neurosurgeons in Shanghai implanted a device with 256 probes on top of the neural cortex of a woman with epilepsy. And she was able to use the device after about 2 weeks to use social media applications, which I presume means to scroll through, and to control a wheelchair. They also have been using it to generate speech in people that are unable to speak. Now, that is impressive because in China, they're speaking Mandarin, which is a much more difficult language to produce electronically. And they're definitely also using this in the United States. A BCI system was used experimentally in the U.S. this last June, and it allowed a man to speak with only a 10-millisecond delay. So that actually starts to feel like something that could be clinically viable. This device involved 65 fine sensors, each one 1/100th the width of a human hair, and they penetrated into the neural cortex. So this procedure is concerning from a safety standpoint because of the risk of brain infection. And fortunately now our miniaturization and our ability to transmit via and not have to have an actual cable coming out of the skull means that I think this technology will move very quickly. And part of me is a little bit nervous about where this may go, and part of me is very excited to think of the possibilities. This one came in from Sandy in Chapel Hill. Sandy writes, recurring colds. I'm a 20-year listener and appreciate every word of your medical knowledge. I've had recurring colds over the past several months. I asked AI to assist me in collecting my thoughts and communicating my symptoms. Now, I'm going to step back and say AI gets a kind of C on this. I did not find the synopsis particularly helpful. I would have loved to have had it in natural language, but I read it a few times, Sandy, and I think I got the gist of it. Basically, first the sore throats, then swollen glands, then nasal congestion, then a cough. Your classic chest cold. Last with some body aches and a fatigue. So all of that suggests viral. The non-localized and migratory aspect of this is just the hallmark for a virus. Bacteria, on the other hand, they don't move around too much unless they get into your bloodstream, and then you're very, very sick. They mostly get where they are and grow. So sinusitis stays in the sinuses. Maybe it seeds the lungs. Maybe it doesn't. Pneumonia doesn't seed the sinuses. It doesn't cause body aches. It sits there, and then most of the other symptoms that are generalized are coming from the immune system trying to fight the bacteria. And fatigue, of course, is a feature of that. But symptoms occurred in February for 2 weeks, late March for 2 weeks, late May for 2 weeks, and began again in July. So this would be frustrating, very much frustrating for Sandy, who's been a regular person. So when you talk to AI, you want to really be careful with your prompt. I would have asked a different question, I think, than the one Sandy did. But I don't see her prompt. I'm just guessing from the response. What we know, what my NI tells me, is we know something's changed, some other factor. So the question is immunity impaired? Has something changed in the functioning of her immunity, which is possible? Or has outside exposures changed? So let's take the first. So outside exposure, stress, maybe mold, maybe a behavior change in terms of not sleeping as well, or a new job where she's got more exposures to people. If it were chronic sinusitis, you'd expect some swelling and some facial tenderness. That would be something. Maybe she started handling a lot of money because she's got a gig at the flea market and she's touching a lot of cash and then eating lunch. Those are all the sorts of things that could kind of pass under your radar, but be really fundamental. As a doctor, the first year you're in the hospital, in the wards, you're sick the whole time because you're touching elevator buttons that have been touched by lots of people, some of them sick. You're touching banisters. Even if you wash your hands before you go in and out of every single room, the entire interior surface of the hospital is potentially contaminated by viruses. Enough virus that you can vector it from your fingers to your face without even knowing what you're doing. We have strong evidence for this when we had masks and we started wearing them because of COVID. The rate that winter, the number of colds that people got was very, very low. I mean, people in the hospitals and elsewhere, people who were out and just wearing masks because they were scared. And sure, there was social distancing and la, la, la. But I think masks played a very big role, and that means external environment change. Immune impairment, that's going to show up probably in first place I'd definitely check a CBC. This is a somewhat older person, so the first thing I start to think about is some kind of blood dysgrasia. Leukemia, I hope it isn't that, Sandy, but leukemia often shows up as frequent colds because the immune system is impaired. Sure, it's putting out lots of white blood cells, but they're cancerous white blood cells that are essentially damaged from birth and unable to do what white blood cell is supposed to do. They're dysfunctional. So lots of dysfunctional cells kind of crowding out the good ones. The obvious place to look for this is in the blood. And Mold, definitely. You can check for mold antigens in the urine, and that's, if that's very high, then a careful environmental look around the place, because if, you know, it's kind of a cause and effect thing. You've got a little bit of allergy in your nose, you scratch your nose more often, you vector more cold viruses into your nose, and you get more frequent colds after not having been doing that. It can be something fairly subtle and not in and of itself noticeable, but it changes your behavior. Assuming that the blood looks good and the kidney function looks good, liver function looks good, then I'm probably going with really taking a close look at the behavior and the environment. Hope that helps, Sandy. If anything I said makes you go, aha, eureka, please let me know. I'd love to hear a follow-up on that. Okay, good. Good news. For the first time in, well, my professional career, I actually agree with the USDA, who puts out the dietary guidelines. You'll notice it's the USDA who puts out the dietary guidelines, and they're basically the Chamber of Commerce for Big Ag. So it's surprising how much the advice that they're giving actually makes sense. So what is that advice? Well, first of all, let's eat adequate protein. And the protein recommendation that they're making is a total of 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight. And then they've taken the food pyramid and they have flipped it over. I love this food pyramid. At the top of the food pyramid, in other words, the pointy parts at the bottom, at the top of the food pyramid, you have protein, dairy, healthy fats, vegetables and fruits, just all the way across. And so, and then there's a picture of all kinds of vegetables and all kinds of fruit and some yogurt and some milk and some whole grain. And then what else have we got? We've got grapes and bananas and butter, avocados, a can of sardines. I mean, all the, basically kind of what I eat. That's based, by the way, on solid science. That's the why I eat that way. But at the bottom, there's a little line, and then it says whole grains. And that's it. The whole grains are this tiny little part of the pyramid. Literally, I would say by, you know, looking at the space, you would need, if you made a stamp the side of the whole grains, you'd need 1, 2, 5. You'd probably need about 9 stamps to cover up the protein, dairy, healthy fats, vegetables, and fruits. It's, what do we limit? Oh, surprise, surprise, highly processed foods. Well, that's no surprise to anyone. Saturated fats should not, that are the type that are in highly processed foods, not more than 10% of daily categories. Let's reduce or abstain from alcohol if you're pregnant or at risk for alcohol use disorders. And let's keep the amount of alcohol down. And they want you to make sure that infants who are breastfed get an extra 400 units of vitamin D, because breastfeeding, while it's wonderful, it does not give them vitamin D, and we really don't want to give them sun for their vitamin D because their skin is too thin and will set them up for melanoma at 25. Give small amounts of peanuts early. Small amounts of peanut butter mixed with breast milk is what they suggest, thinning it to a safe consistency. This is for children who have a sibling with peanut allergy, because you know what? Small doses work to prevent allergy. Now let's get to the bad. The bad is the order, which is, thank God, not binding, the executive order from the President of the United States, reducing the number of recommended childhood vaccines from 18 to 11, and directing government health officials to separate the doses in measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. I guess Trump doesn't know that no American company even manufactures the individual components for measles, mumps, and rubella, and that they would all need to be given in multiple shots, and the chances of shots being missed, just statistically and logistically, it's a nightmare to imagine. Instead of giving two shots, two, count them, you have to give 15. Okay, yeah, that's not going to work. and they're nuts. So that's the bad. It's just bad. Let's hepatitis B. Let's not do that. Okay. Well, unlike Denmark, who Trump is trying to emulate, we have a problem with mother-to-child transmission of hepatitis B, and immunizing the child protects them from liver cancer for the rest of their life. In parts of Asia, many people are infected with hepatitis B in infancy through breastfeeding or close contact with their mother. Their mother isn't sick. They don't get sick. They just get the potential to get cancer. So now we've done the good, the bad. Let's do the ugly. And the ugly is the complete ridiculous nonsense that allows events like the following. Here's a 26-year-old woman. She's a heart transplant survivor. She got her heart transplant when she was a preteen. And 1 year after her surgery, she started taking an anti-rejection group, a drug. I might add, a generic. Her insurer, Elevance, told her last year it would no longer cover the drug. So she went on Facebook, because she's 26, and her post got shared, and the next day the insurance restored her coverage, but instead of 180 per month for a 90-day supply, she is now being charged 1,000 per 90-day supply, which technically is a ghost approval. You approved it, but they can't afford it. Now, here's where the story gets really good. The Independent published a story on Mary Cutter. Mary Cutter's only child died in 2012, and it was his heart that was donated to Harris. So Cutter has offered to pay for the drug so that her child's heart can keep beating. That was accepted, of course, by the young woman. Mark Cuban wrote in a response to one of Harris's posts and said, approve and pay for the heart transplant, deny the generic rejection. This is beyond incredible. Now, of course, he happens to own a generic pharmacy. So he supplies Harris's medication for $300 for 90 days. That's basically the cost of his policy is cost of the drug plus 15% for profit, plus 5 for handling. That's it. That's what that pharmacy costs. So if you didn't know about Cost Plus or Mark Cuban Cost Plus Pharmacy, highly recommend that you check it out. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.